One, the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ana Mateo. This program is for English learners, so we speak a bit slower, and we use words and phrases with English learners in mind. Today is September 13th. Here are the stories we have for you on today's program. For our education story, Dr. Jill Robbins brings us a story on how universities in the United States are facing back to school during the coronavirus pandemic. John Russell tells us a story about North and South Korean couples. For this week's Words in Their Stories, I explain a common expression about a common animal in the United States. And we finish today's show with Steve Ember and the Making of a Nation, our ongoing series about U.S. history. But first, here is Dr. Jill.
Many colleges and universities across the United States have opened again after the summer vacation. But the school year looks different than it ever has before. Schools are taking new actions to fight COVID-19 infections on campus. Such actions include moving suddenly between in-person and online learning, punishing students for attending parties, and testing local wastewater for the virus. The state of Arkansas's Department of Health reports that the number of COVID-19 cases in the state among 18 to 24-year-olds rose by nearly 17% in the first week of September. The number of active infections at the University of Arkansas's main campus is close to 1,000. Most of those with the virus are students. The rise came days after the school moved to restrict on-campus events and off-campus parties. The school told students it would consider organizing or attending large gatherings without face coverings or social distancing to be a violation of student rules. In Tallahassee, Florida, officials at Florida State University tested more than 3,000 students and employees over a one-week period. 21% of those tested were confirmed to have COVID-19. Shortly before the test period, pictures and videos of students attending parties had appeared on social media. In the images, the students do not appear to be following social distancing rules. Few are wearing face coverings. In a statement, university officials asked local businesses to help slow the spread of disease by restricting students from gathering in large groups. Another university in Florida, the University of Florida in Gainesville, is experiencing a similar infection rate. More than 21% of those who came to the Student Health Center have tested positive for COVID-19. Some schools, seeing rises in case numbers, have temporarily moved classes online. On September 8th, West Virginia University canceled in-person classes for undergraduates at the university's main campus in Morgantown. The classes will be online through September 25th. One small college in the state of Illinois, Bradley University, is requiring all of its students to quarantine for 2 weeks. Officials said that classes would also return to online learning for a short time. In order to test a lot of students at once, many schools are studying the wastewater from student living spaces. The tests can show whether there is any sign of the virus among the people living in a given building. The school can then ask those students to quarantine for a period of time. Ryan Schmutz is a student at Utah State University. He recently received a text message from his school saying that COVID-19 had been found in his building's wastewater. University workers quickly took him and other students to a COVID-19 testing center. Schmutz was then among 300 students who had to stay in their rooms for many days earlier this month. Back at West Virginia University, or WVU, 29 students were recently forced to leave school because of COVID-19-related charges. School officials say the students took actions that could have put other students' health at risk. The university is considering taking other actions against the students, the WVU Today student newspaper reported. One of the strongest punishments against students happened earlier this month at Northeastern University in Boston, Massachusetts. 11 first-year students were sent home for gathering in a hotel room used for student housing. They were told they cannot return to school during the autumn term. The students and their parents are now fighting the severe penalty the students faced. University officials have said the students will not get their money back for the autumn term program they were taking part in, which costs $36,500. I'm Jill Robbins.
Now John Russell tells us a story about North and South Korean couples and the differences they face.
A year ago, Kim So-yeon gave some very important personal information to her South Korean love interest. She had fled North Korea about 10 years earlier. Kim provided the information on her second date with Lee Jong-sup. Kim and Lee got married at a Seoul hotel in June, but Kim's family, still in North Korea, could not attend the wedding ceremony. "In South Korea, my husband is my everything. I have no one else here." Such marriages are becoming increasingly common in South Korea. More than 70% of the 33,000 North Koreans who have fled to South Korea are women. There are no official numbers on how many North Koreans have married South Korean men. But a 2019 government-financed study looked at 3,000 North Koreans living in the South. The findings suggested that 43% of married women from North Korea had South Korean husbands. In 2011, that number was about 19%. North Korean women often have difficulties adjusting to life in South Korea. They often face discrimination and loneliness. Some said they married South Korean men to help them with their new lives. Some of the couples, however, have difficulties. They share a language and ethnicity, but they can often seem like foreigners to one another. They are, after all, attempting to bridge a 75-year-old division of the Korean Peninsula. Lee said he tries to use fewer English words while speaking with his wife. She sometimes confuses him by using North Korean expressions that he does not understand. Wang said that she feels really, really happy when her husband, So Min-seok, takes her to a gathering of his friends and their wives. She says they often ask her questions about North Korea. So said he does not usually ask Wang about her past in North Korea. An Kyung-soo is a researcher with a private group that studies health issues in the North. An said some of the North Koreans that he has spoken to have told him that their South Korean husbands looked down on them and abused them. Kim So-yeon said she misses her parents and younger sister in North Korea and hopes to reunite with them one day. Now my husband is filling my heart. My mother-in-law treats me well. So does my sister-in-law. It's like having strong supporters in my life, and I'm happy now, Kim said. I'm John Russell.
And now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. On this program, we teach common words and expressions in American English. Today, we talk about an animal found in many parts of the United States, deer. Washington, D.C. is home to many deer. They are sweet-looking, especially the baby fawns with their white spots. In the city, they are fun to watch, but they do cause trouble. They make a lot of gardeners angry because deer eat almost everything. In many parts of America, you will see road warning signs about deer. Adults are not little animals. An average male weighs about 135 kilograms. Deer sometimes leap into the path of fast-moving traffic. This can have serious, sometimes deadly results. And that is what brings us to today's expression. Like a deer caught in headlights. Deer will often stop suddenly in the middle of a road and stare into the lights of a vehicle coming toward them. They appear frozen in place or caught in the headlights. When people are in a state of extreme surprise, fear, or confusion, we say they are like deer caught in headlights. They seem so frightened that they cannot think clearly. They do not know what to do, so they do not do anything. Sometimes we shorten the phrase and simply say, like a deer in headlights. This is a little different from being called doe-eyed. A doe is a grown female deer. People who are doe-eyed are innocent. Clueless. They are unaware of what's going on around them. Now, please keep this in mind. We usually use like a deer caught in headlights in situations that are not life-threatening. For example, people who have stage fright often look like a deer in headlights. Let's say I am acting in a play. I know all my lines and feel ready. But on opening night, as I look out into the audience and see all those faces, I freeze. I forget all my lines and stare into space, unable to speak. Someone watching might say, "What is wrong with Anna? Is she supposed to just stand there doing nothing? She's like a deer caught in headlights." So the next time you are really surprised or scared, you may find yourself looking frozen and wide-eyed, like a deer in headlights. And that brings us to the end of this Words and Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Anna Mateo. There's no escape.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. In our last program, we talked about President Thomas Jefferson's decisions about who would be in his new government. Jefferson was the leader of a new political party, the Republican Party, but not the Republican Party we know today. In fact, Jefferson's party laid the roots for today's Democratic Party. During the election of 1800, the Jeffersonian Republicans struggled bitterly with the opposition party, the Federalists. Jefferson won that election. In his inaugural address of 1801, he said he wanted to work with the Federalists for the good of the nation. But he chose no Federalists for his cabinet. All the cabinet officers were strong Republicans. All were loyal to Thomas Jefferson. Once President Jefferson formed his cabinet, he began planning the policies of his administration.
Jefferson, of course, thought central government should be almost invisible. He saw its prime role as acting as a sort of referee between the various states, and he wanted to keep it to a minimum.
Andrew O'Shaughnessy directs a Center for Jefferson Studies at Monticello, Thomas Jefferson's home in Virginia. He says Jefferson was especially concerned about the public debt. In the first year of Jefferson's presidency, the government owed millions of dollars. Each year, the debt grew larger because of the interest charged on these loans. Jefferson wanted to balance the budget. Jefferson discussed his financial policy with his two closest advisors. The advisors were Secretary of State James Madison and Treasury Secretary Albert Gallatin. The men agreed that the government must stop spending as much money as it did under former President John Adams, and they agreed that the government must pay its debts as quickly as possible. Albert Gallatin said, "We must have a strong policy. The debt must be paid. If we do not do this, our children, our grandchildren, and many generations to come will have to pay for our mistakes." Jefferson began saving money by cutting unnecessary jobs in the executive branch. He reduced the number of ambassadors, and he dismissed all the tax inspectors. Congress would have to take the next steps. Most government offices, Jefferson said, were created by laws of Congress. Congress alone must act on these positions. The citizens of the United States have paid for these jobs with their taxes. It is not right or just for the government to take more than it needs from the people. President Jefferson also wanted to cut taxes on the production and sale of some products, including whiskey and tobacco. He hoped the government could get all the money it needed from import taxes and from the sale of public lands. The Federalists were furious. They warned that Jefferson's financial program would crush the nation. They declared there would be anarchy if Federalist officials were dismissed. Most people, however, were happy. They liked what Jefferson said. They especially liked his plan to cut taxes. Jefferson's biggest critic was his longtime political opponent, Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton had served as the nation's first Treasury Secretary. Now he was a private lawyer in New York City. He published his criticism of Jefferson in a newspaper he started, the New York Evening Post. In Congress, elected officials also debated the president's proposal to cut taxes. Federalists said it was dangerous for the government to depend mainly on import taxes. They said such a policy would lead to smuggling. People would try to bring goods into the United States secretly without paying customs fees on them. Federalists also said that if the United States cut taxes, it would not have enough money to pay its debts. Then no one would want to invest in the United States again. Republicans said they were not afraid of smugglers. The danger, they said, would come from taxing the American people. There was no need for production and sales taxes. And they said the American people knew it. The Republicans also said they were sure the government would have enough money to pay its debts. The Republicans won this legislative fight. Both the Senate and the House of Representatives voted to approve the president's plan to cut taxes. Congress also had another of Jefferson's proposals to debate. Jefferson wanted to reduce the number of federal courts. The issue had roots in the political divisions between the Federalist and Republican parties, and it started in the closing days of the previous president's term. John Adams was a Federalist. Before Adams left office, Congress passed a Judiciary Act. This act gave Adams the power to appoint as many judges as he wished. The act was a way for the Federalists to keep control of one branch of government after losing the presidency and their majority in Congress in the election of 1800. So President Adams quickly created new courts and named new judges. Just as quickly, the Senate approved them. The papers of appointment were signed. The appointed men were known as Midnight Judges. However, some of the Midnight Judges did not receive their papers or commissions before Thomas Jefferson was sworn into office. The new president refused to give them their commissions. Federalist congressmen claimed that the president was trying to interfere with the judiciary. This interference, they said, violated the Constitution. Republican congressmen argued that the Constitution gave Congress the power to create and eliminate courts. They said the former administration had no right to appoint the so-called midnight judges. The Republicans won this argument, too. Congress approved President Jefferson's proposal to reduce the federal courts. Congress then turned to other business. But the question of the midnight judges would not die. One reason the issue remained important was because of a man named William Marbury. Marbury was one of the midnight judges who had never received his commission. He asked the Supreme Court to decide whether the government was required to give him his commission. The Chief Justice of the United States, John Marshall, was a member of the Federalist Party.
Jefferson and Marshall hate each other. In fact, Marshall gives him the oath for the inauguration, and goes back to his room and says, well, a terrorist has just taken over the government. I hope we will be able to survive him.
Joseph Ellis is a historian who has written many books about early American history. He says John Marshall was a towering figure who had an entirely different view of the federal government than Jefferson. Marshall believed the Supreme Court should have the right to veto bills passed by Congress and signed by the president. In the Marbury case, he saw a chance to put this idea into law. Marshall wrote his decision carefully. First, he said that Marbury did have a legal right to his judicial commission. Then he said that Marbury had been denied this legal right. He said no one, not even the president, could take away a person's legal rights. Next, Marshall noted that Marbury had taken his request to the Supreme Court under the terms of a law passed in 1789. That law gave citizens the right to ask the high court to order action by any lower court or by any government official. Marshall explained that the Constitution carefully limits the powers of the Supreme Court. The court can hear direct requests involving diplomats or the states. It cannot rule on other cases until a lower court has ruled. So, Marshall said, the 1789 law allowed Marbury to take his case directly to the Supreme Court. But the Constitution did not. The Constitution, he added, is the first law of the land. Therefore, the congressional law is unconstitutional and has no power. Chief Justice Marshall succeeded in doing all he had hoped to do. He made clear that Marbury had a right to his judicial commission. He also saved himself from a battle with the administration. Most importantly, he claimed for the Supreme Court the power to rule on laws passed by Congress. The case of Marbury versus Madison established that the Supreme Court, not the President or the Congress, has the final say on what the Constitution means. Jefferson did not like Marshall's decision, but Joseph Ellis says that Jefferson was awed by how the Chief Justice argued his case.
Jefferson says to his friends, if you ever talk to Marshall, don't say anything, because whatever you say, he will take it and he will twist it. He calls about twistifications of John Marshall.
Jefferson waited for the Supreme Court to use this new power to change Congress's laws. Several times during Jefferson's presidency, Federalists claimed that laws passed by the Republican Congress violated the Constitution. But they never asked the Supreme Court to reject those laws. The case of Marbury versus Madison was one of the most important decisions about how America's government operates. But historians say another act during Thomas Jefferson's presidency affected America in an even bigger way.
And that's our program for today. We hope you enjoyed it. Join us again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Anna Mateo.